This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by Ask Me Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Does anyone remember the days with full John L? It's thanks to him no child of mine will know the breaker's hell. Tell me, which side are you on?
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 Good evening. This is Labor Radio. I'm Lane Ponce, and I'm with the Communication Workers of America Retirees Group and my co-host, Tim. How about an introduction?
I'm Tim Flanagan with the Portland Community College Faculty Federation, and we're here tonight to talk about how labor unions are presented by the corporate media.
Which KBOO is not one of. We're
certainly
lucky
not
to be here because of that. And we have a few guests tonight. We have Dave Mazza, who is the editor of the Portland Alliance, and Tom Hastings, who is a writer for the Peace Worker and also the director of the Peace and Nonviolent Track at the Conflict Resolution Program at Portland State. So we have some distinguished guests. We also will be hearing from Mick Mulcrone. They're all looking around to see if there's someone else coming in, but no, they are the distinguished guests. Mick Mulcrone, Associate Professor at University of Portland in Communication Studies and Journalism, will be joining us at about 6:10. So we know that there might be some listeners out there that have something to say about this, so we'll be taking calls anytime after 6:30 this evening. And you could jot down this number, 503-231-8187, for call-ins after 6:30. So where do we start? How about an introduction? How would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, I guess probably most folks know me as editor of the Portland Alliance. However, I've worked in a variety of capacities. I was actually the communications director for SEIU Local 503 for a number of years, which let me get a close-up look at corporate media and how they view our labor unions.
Right, and they are our sponsor of our show this evening.
Oh,
so
great.
That's good news. And Tom, how about you?
You just heard from Dave Mazza. I'm Tom Hastings. I teach at PSU and at PCC. Just one course over there at PCC. But, I teach peace studies, and I edit the first 90% of the Peace Worker, and then I pass it on to more intelligent people down in Salem for the final massive edit. And then it goes to press every month. And like Dave and like KABU, we are a member of the alternative media. And all of our alternative media, I think, are pretty darn labor-friendly.
Good, good. We've no complaints about that. Do you have other people in the alternative that you can name for us that you work with? You call it the alternative media? Is that an organization?
No, I just meant as a sort of a generic label of like the Portland Alliance, like the Peace Worker, like KABU,
right.
any of the sort of non-mainstream media that we find. One of our students, she's Native American in our Conflict Resolution Master's program, is trying to find funding to start a Native American newspaper in Portland. That would certainly be alternative media around here. I think that all of these almost they're constituent niche publications, but they're successful, and I think Portland does a very good job of supporting them.
Right. I know, Tim, you pulled some stuff off of the internet before you came in, and you had one that was the alternative news resource .org is available to us that are outside. I guess what we want to talk about tonight also is how do you view the mainstream's view of labor issues or progressive issues?
Well, I'll jump in first, I guess. Obviously, it's no surprise to most folks that the mainstream press does a fairly miserable job of reporting on the labor movement. They don't get it. And I think that's for a number of reasons. And it's not all the reporters' fault, even though folks do like to vent against them. I mean, first of all, I think it's important to keep in mind we live in a society right now where organized labor only represents, depending on where you look and the numbers you look, somewhere around 10-12%. The vast majority of the population has not been part of the labor movement. And they don't have that firsthand knowledge. There's also the fact that the media, mainstream press, has undergone tremendous centralization and consolidation as corporations have turned it into infotainment rather than news. So fewer and fewer reporters with less and less time to get out there and get experienced about what the issue is about. So from a structural point of view and an audience point of view, there's already two strikes against unions trying to get their message out there. We have a public that's not really up on what the issue is all about, and we have reporters who neither have the ability nor the experience. I mean, every newspaper used to have labor beat reporters who, that's what they did. They go down and make the rounds of the union halls and cover the strikes and what have you. That was figured just as important of a beat as covering business. Now, of course, that's, you know, except in the labor press, we don't see that sort of thing. So that sort of erosion has had a big impact, and consequently, you know, I've dealt with reporters who really have good intentions, but based on their questions, they are totally clueless about the concept of, you know, the relationship between corporate America and organized labor and the class struggle.
Right, right. Well, Tom, you have some perspective from the progressive movement. What do you think goes on with the press there?
Well, I'm not even sure if I'm a progressive. I think Dave is a better progressive than I am.
Pigeonhole you with labels.
Well, yeah, I have different sort of lines of division of thinking and about all of this, I think, than progressives. I tend to think in terms of violence and nonviolence, and I look at this and I see how sad it is that the labor movement, for example, preceded the civil rights movement in pioneering the sit-ins and the occupations and sit-downs beginning in the 1930s. My family was involved in the Teamsters strike in 1934 in Minneapolis, including one of my great uncles who was put in a hospital by the goons who were hired by the companies. And it was the year before that, in 1933, that the founder of our movement, the one that I'm part of, the Catholic Worker Movement, Dorothy Day, started that. And she came straight out of the labor movement, straight out of women's suffrage, and tried to combine sort of works of mercy with resisting the victims of the war system, is how she put it. But all of her journalistic background was straight out of essentially the labor movement. So you've got this really interesting history with the Flint strike, and I think that was 1935, preceding, as I said, the civil rights movement by almost 20 years in the sit-ins, pioneering these nonviolent techniques. And yet, just as today we see in so many struggles, one act of violence makes it easier to smear the movements with this kind of, you have to be afraid of the unions, they're all thugs. And that has been really, unfortunately, effective to the point where, as I've personally been a member of four labor unions in my life, and it's a struggle to overcome the problems of image that young workers have, even those who are in the unions. Well, you know, I don't really like the union. well, why don't you like the union? Well, what did they ever do for me? They're just a bunch of, they're putting money in their pockets, they're corrupt, and they're violent.
They've done a lot for you.
And,
they forget about the 40-hour week, pensions, and decent working hours, and justice, and a voice on the job site.
And much more. You're absolutely right. And it's like the young women now sort of forget to thank the last couple of generations of women for the rights that they now take for granted. And each generation, as we see in the labor movement, has to defend everything that the mothers and fathers and grandparents fought so hard for. They have to continue to fight for those. And as a union official, you clearly know that, and so do you, Lane.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that, you know, union leadership, union leadership reached sort of a nadir at the same time that business forces, corporate forces, really found, you know, some dynamic leadership like Ronald Reagan.
Huh.
You know, we're dealing with Lane Kirkland, who's allowing the labor movement to fall apart, and his ilk. And then we have Ronald Reagan come in, and over the course of 8 years, really change the attitudes in this country toward labor. I mean, what was his first act? Is to bust the air controllers union,
yep,
to make it clear this is a new day. And just as he went after welfare queens, he went after big labor bosses,
yep,
and created a whole mythology which several generations live with now, that when we go out and talk to people and try to organize them in the workplace, you're hearing Reaganisms coming out of their mouths. Of course, that's been perpetuated in the press, is why they're hearing that. And it's the same old thing, as you've outlined. You know, the union's there to take money out of your pocket. They're somehow criminals. You know, even though we live in a world where corporations like Coca-Cola quite readily go out and get involved in killing trade unionists in other countries, you know, if you want to get talking about who's the hitman in the situation, and, you know, bring up images like Jimmy Hoffa, it's truly obscene. But again, it's just one of those unfortunate confluences that occurred that have, you know, put us kind of in this bind.
Right. But, you know, on the other hand, whenever I was involved with anything to do with the union, I always associated with people that were of the highest. They had high integrity. They were devoted to the issues. They did a lot of things on their own time. You know, all those things, the individuals that you work with make the whole myth impossible, mm-hmm, to even acknowledge. And yet, the media doesn't really get down to that lower level. They just do that smear.
So why is it that people remember the Jimmy Hoffa associations and they forget about the union members standing next to Martin Luther King,
yeah,
in those marches?
Yeah. And
what controls what they remember? If you believe the broadcast television, we have a liberal media. You don't think that's true?
Well, I think we've got a liberal media if we just look at it from the sort of grassroots level, which is the reporter level. But that's very different than the corporate office up here. And I think we see that time and time again. You find young reporters who come into it, and I mean, I got a master's in journalism. I know at least what one institution is teaching, and it is, like Lane said, it's the same thing in education. We try to turn out really good young journalists with high ideals and high ethics, high ethical standards, and yet when they get out in the world, then that corporate media drains that away from them because of the gatekeeping that comes from the corporate offices down.
So the perception of a liberal media is correct in one respect. A lot of reporters are liberal.
Yes, reporters.
Maybe it's because they're well-informed.
Yeah, and they know from their education how to critically think. I mean, this is what we're supposed to do at the university, community college level, all of these levels. We're supposed to teach them the values of increasingly high levels of cognitive, critical approach to material. So they come out prepared, and then they go out in the workaday world, and it gets bled out of them all too often.
And those so-called liberal reporters don't determine what gets published.
That's
either.
For sure. They're just the first gatekeepers, and oftentimes they'll take in really good stories and have them killed off.
Editors have a tremendous, well, they have the control over what gets done, and the editors are under the pressure of the front office.
Well, we have Mick Mulcrone on the line, and he is, he's teaching journalism out at University of Portland, so let's hear some of his opinions on our topic tonight. Hello, Mick.
Hello, Elaine. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much for being on the phone and talking to our viewers.
Very happy to be here.
So have you been listening in to this ongoing conversation?
It's a very interesting and important conversation.
Okay. And what would you like to add or question about what's gone on so far?
Well, I think it's a multifaceted problem. Certainly, concentration of ownership is one of the problems at hand. And it all gets down to who gets to tell the story, and labor does not get to tell its own story. Another manifestation of that, or another contributing factor to that, I think, is a professionalization of journalism. A couple of generations ago, up until the 1950s, 1960s, when labor beats were a normal part of daily newspaper journalism, reporters weren't necessarily college educated. They came from the communities they covered, and they were more inclined, out of experience, I mean, they came out of the working class, to be more sympathetic to labor issues. When I was a kid, I grew up in a lower middle class neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio. A guy down the street, Bob Kehoe, son of immigrants like I am, was a labor reporter. And he had a high school education, and he worked for the Cleveland Press. Cleveland Press was one of three newspapers in Cleveland at the time. Today, I think 97% of cities in America over a certain population are one newspaper town, so that there isn't that competition. There isn't that drive to tell other stories rather than the middle. So I think that's part of it. I think another problem is that entertainment programming, I think that was alluded to by a couple of your guests, entertainment programming is throwing a stereotype out there of what union people are like. I was going through my head earlier today trying to figure out, just from my own viewing of television, what was the last entertainment depiction that I saw of somebody from organized labor? And it was in The Sopranos, corrupt union thug. Working people in non-professional jobs aren't depicted in entertainment media. If you watch TV, the big professions are doctors, lawyers, and cops. So I think these negative stereotypes have a cumulative effect as well. And one other thing I would point to, and I think that until recently, labor has not done a very good job of getting its own story out there, organized labor. I think that there's some encouraging signs of change. The fact that Walmart is on the run today and is on the defensive is largely because organized labor has been very sophisticated and very effective in getting its a nuanced critique of Walmart out before the public. And I think the success of the UPS strike, the last big labor success in, I think, 99, labor did an excellent job of telling the story of those workers that were on strike. So I think there are some encouraging signs out there.
And what about, as your profession as a journalistic teacher,
mm-hmm.
how is that going with your students, and what message do you drive home to them?
Well, most of them come from middle-class backgrounds. One thing I encourage them to do is to broaden their experiences. I think the most important education that I got, apart from formal education, is working in the steel mills, in factories. I was a construction laborer in Alaska. I learned as much about life in those realms as I certainly did in more formal settings. And I encourage students to get out into the community and to experience people outside of their own realm, outside of their own comfort zone. And I think that develops empathy. That's one thing that they can do. Broaden the terms of their education. I guess that's what I kind of preach.
Because they are, in fact, going to be professional journalists, not on the beat, on the street kind of journalists.
Well, I mean, entry-level jobs, they have you doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they need to get beyond their own experience. You know, work as a farm worker during the summer. Get a factory job if you can. Work in a mill if you can find a mill that's still viable. Don't just work for, you know, in an office setting that your uncle can get for you. there's nothing wrong with privilege, but I think students need to get beyond the confines of their own class backgrounds.
That seems like good advice. Do we have any questions from the round table here? I know, Dave, you were saying that you and Mick had a encounter not too long ago. What was that about?
We had a conversation.
Conversation?
Actually, it's been quite a long time ago when I discovered they wouldn't carry the Portland Lions on campus at UP. So we never followed up. We were going to have a little talk about trying to do something about that. But
it is back on campus now.
It is. Oh, good.
Gratified to be able to say. I'm not sure how that happened, but I just picked a copy up actually today, purely coincidentally.
Well, one thing I was going to say in terms of the students, we get a lot of students coming to us wanting to do internships. There does seem to be a desire to find out all aspects of journalism, including alternative journalism, which I find refreshing.
Yes.
I've relied heavily on Reed students and some students from PSU in particular, but Reed especially, very talented people. The other interesting aspect of it is that from a demographics, it's largely women who are coming interested in going into the alternative media. I'm not sure why that is, but
actually, something like over 60% of communication studies students are female now. I'm not sure why that is either. But
I'm running a higher percentage in terms of our internship. We're probably running 75 to 85% of the people who do internships there are women, and quite talented, but very interested in breaking out of the constrictions of the traditional education and finding out, what else is out there.
That's encouraging.
So, Tom, what do you want to add?
Yeah, I think the internships are important. I know that when I was getting my little J degree, I wound up writing for Muznayegan, which in Anishinaabe means talking paper, and did a lot of trips with a Native American photojournalist, and he and I partnered on many stories around the Upper Great Lakes area, and it was just a beautiful life experience. It changed me. I had been involved in the treaty rights struggle somewhat, but this sent me off to travel and really kind of get on the inside of the stories. And I just think breaking out of whatever box you're in, even if it's an alternative box, sending kids out to white kids to the Scanner or the Observer or the Asian Times. I mean, do an internship outside your niche.
Yeah. Have you attempted to do any of that, or are your students interested in doing any of that, as far as you can tell?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, Mick.
Yeah, I have one of the visitors I have regularly when I teach a particular class is Don McIntosh from the Northwest Labor Press to talk about advocacy journalism. The central mantra in journalism education is the need to be objective, but I think that's a very kind of closed and incomplete view of what journalism can be. Certainly there's lots of room for advocacy and lots of room for deliberately trying to expose wrongs and correct them.
Of course, some people would say all press is advocacy, that the mainstream press is simply advocating for capitalism.
And objectivity is impossible anyway. Facts always have to be explained and put into some kind of context.
Exactly.
We're going to either announce our advocacy or it'll remain hidden beneath the fake rubric of neutrality and objectivity.
Good point.
So did you have something to say, Tim?
Yeah, Mick, you brought up a key point as to what might create and sustain objectivity. Years ago, major media outlets, especially big newspapers, had a labor beat. And the corporate media really doesn't have that type of beat anymore. Back then, reporters developed personal relationships with their union sources, just like a business beat or a police beat develops relationships with their sources, and this gives you a more true picture of the labor movement. Instead, we're getting stereotypes of the labor movement in a very conservative economic press, and I'm not sure what we can do about that. What do you think?
I think labor has to accept that as a given. and get more sophisticated in responding to that kind of coverage. I looked to the UPS strike, and organized labor did a superb job in telling the story there. They actually used UPS's advertising strategies against them. UPS had this campaign about, you know, the UPS workers in brown and how great they are. That was part of their TV advertising. And unions were able to turn that around and say, yeah, these are the UPS workers that you're talking about, and they're not, a lot of them are not getting a living wage. And people, that resonated with people. And there was one of the reasons for the success of the strike, even though it did inconvenience people, and most strikes are covered from the perspective of how they inconvenience the public. But in this case, the public resonated to the plight of the workers, and it was public support for them that I think turned the tide.
And I think being proactive, even on the day-to-day basis for organized labor, for example, several years ago when I was doing a lot of media work with Jobs with Justice, we had a situation where hotel workers were trying to organize, and it was around the issue of being exposed to a lot of toxics. Their hands were bleeding from the toxics. And Willamette Week went out there and did a story. And when they got done, everybody, the workers were very excited that this was being covered. The story came out, and what the story was about was how the union was running a stealth campaign to organize the workers, and they were using this phony toxics issue. I mean, it was, they never even talked to any union official. They talked to one or two workers and then quoted extensively from what management had to say. Obviously, the workers were depressed. Well, rather than just stand there and take it, we organized a delegation, made an appointment with the editor of Willamette Week, marched into his office and said, you know, this is not acceptable. And he, of course, immediately took the position, well, you know, the person checked his facts. We couldn't find anything inaccurate. And it was like, well, you know, here's the story. You report on a labor issue maybe once in a blue moon, and then what you do, you pick one that shows unions as being deceptive. Now, even if that story is factual, it's really perpetuating a bigger misconception, because that's the only time your readers get news about labor is it's bad news. You have to balance it and, you know, provide some sort of other image so people understand what's going on. Anyway, you know, he wouldn't do a retraction on the story on the particular campaign, but he did end up hiring someone who started reporting more regularly, and I'll say a lot more fairly, about labor issues. And I think, you know, unions need to be much more aggressive on that basis. As soon as something pops up, that's what corporate America does. They see something they don't like, they're all over the place with their PR people. And I think some unions are getting more sophisticated in that respect, but it needs to be, you know, down at the grassroots level as well.
Well, and like we mentioned earlier, the grassroots level is being weeded out, and we're down to maybe 10-11% of the population are union organized jobs. So that's part of the problem too, is we're battling lower numbers and our exposure is less and less. I mean, things do bubble up. Like, we had that really fantastic issue around the Perry Center with young workers and young people that were organized and really stepped up to the union cause there, and that got some coverage, but not a lot.
And we don't want to perpetuate any myths here tonight. The decline in union membership has kind of leveled off. I think just this month we added 300 nurses here in town, and that made a big dent.
Yeah, actually, the Labor Department released stats just this week, and nationally it's stabilized at about 12.5% of the working population. So that's an encouraging sign. It actually went down a little bit in Oregon, though.
Oh, you had to add that.
But it's temporary.
And also, the 12.5% is with the public sector unions included.
Yes, yeah. Private and public.
And then what is going to happen if, for example, Walmart is unionized? Is that a real soon possibility in anybody's mind?
First of all, pigs will fly, isn't that?
That's about it, yeah. In North Carolina, when they were facing unionization, they closed down the plant.
Yes, that's what large corporations have the option of doing.
Yeah.
We've seen it all over the country. So, yeah, Well, did you have any other comments you'd like to make, Mr. Mulcrone?
Oh, you can call me Mick. And, no, I have to actually go and teach a class. But thank you very much for the opportunity to contribute. And thank you. Thanks to the other participants.
Sure. Thank you for calling in, and have a good class tonight.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mick. Thanks, nice Mick. To meet you, Mick.
Okay. Now we're back to our own little foursome here. Keep this thing going. So where do we want to go now?
Can I mention one thing about this notion of the image of unions in this country? I think that it really is time to wrestle with that image and to proactively do something about it. I really agree with that. Because when I talk to students, I ask them, well, what's going on, for example, with our military aid to other countries? And who benefits? Who dies, who gets hurt, and who gets ahead? And one of the first things that I talk about is collective bargaining rights. So you go to these other countries, like Colombia is a salient example now. When we send military aid down there, who are the people who get killed? Literally dozens of union organizers at the very grassroots level have been killed in the past few months in Colombia by the same forces that receive our military aid, both in terms of military materials and in terms of just raw funding so that they can buy whatever they want. This is how our military aid is being spent in other countries where the people know the value of collective bargaining and are so desperately trying for it. So our government is operated through its corporate media to ruin the image of labor unions in the United States. And so our workers here are well and truly fooled quite often about that. And I see it in young workers fairly frequently. They come on board, as I said earlier, and just they're clueless about what the unions stand for and the good that they do. But the workers in other countries are desperately trying for collective bargaining rights, and we are this government is the major force on planet Earth that's trying to wreck that and is succeeding here and there through death. That's a pretty heavy process. Murder.
Okay, so just back that up and let us know and our listening audience know what the deal with that is. Why do they target the labor organizers in those countries?
Well, we've got this structural imperialism that's been operating for a long time. I mean, the first version came out of Europe, and it was colonialism. And now the more sophisticated version is called globalization. And I call it globalization of predatory capitalism. And what it is there's a quid pro quo. We give you this, Uribe, and you give us that. We give you all the military aid you need to maintain your power. You can't defeat the FARC, and you'll have a fairly weak central government, but you can maintain the power that you have. And the quid pro quo there is we want you to go ahead and have all the environment and labor laws on the books you want. Don't enforce any of them. We want to externalize all of our costs when we come into your country. We want cheap human resources and we want cheap natural resources. That's the deal. We give you military aid. You give us cheap resources, both human and natural.
And what form of media is discovering this and reporting it? Do we see it? Do we hear it? How do you know this?
I think activist media on the ground. When we have the human rights community globally, and they inform everybody, and then we in the alternative media try to report on it here.
It gets increasingly confusing with the press as well, because often in many of these countries, I'm thinking of Mexico and Colombia and what have you, you generally have an official union that is controlled by the government and is usually quite corrupt. And that's what gets reported on as being the union in the press. And those who are trying to build free, independent unions are generally stereotyped as, you know, being radical, dangerous, violent people, when of course it's just the opposite. These people are being victimized by the government unions, who don't want to see the boat rocked because they've got themselves a sweetheart deal. And of course our media doesn't bother to dig much beyond that. You really do have to go into groups like excuse me, the Alternative Press, International Monitor. There's a variety of publications that are really watching those sorts of things and reporting on them, but unfortunately it never gets beyond that. I think there's another thing that happens here as well, is that is a reflection of the traditions of the labor movement here as opposed to elsewhere, thanks to people like George Meany, who really pulled the teeth, or thought he pulled the teeth. They're not, they're coming back, but pulled the teeth of the labor movement, the radical aspect of the labor movement, and wanted to refine or restrict unionism to just dealing with how much I get paid, you know, do I get some benefits, and that's it, and a pension. And not looking at it as really building a working class for a broader social agenda, which, of course, you know, we know from the Wobblies and the Knights of Labor and, the, you know, the Molly Maguires, which is really what, you know, much of labor, organized labor, was about in its early years. And that heritage has remained. And so it's really difficult. When I was with SEIU, we had tremendous times, difficult times, getting our members, some of our members, to understand that the union had to be political because that's where the fight was.
Right.
Instead, it was like, no, you should do collective bargaining, and they didn't even like the idea, some of them didn't even like the idea of striking. So, you know, it's, there's been these currents within organized labor in this country that have had a tremendous impact on how we were able to be effective and how we're seen in the press. The press obviously is interested with their corporate backers to continue to promote that tamer, detoothed version of organized labor.
Right, the professional people who happen to have a bargaining unit.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Remember that famous George Meany quote, I never carried a lunch bucket.
Oh.
That was really endearing to the hearts of those of us who were in the working
class.
Carry
lunch buckets.
That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it all kind of ties in with this, you know, the impending death of the middle class and how that's related to the media and the coverage of it. Do you see a connection there, or do you think that's not? Is that another myth, that the middle class is dying?
Oh, I think the middle class is being redefined back to where the elites want it to be. I mean, I think that, you know, as people are getting spread thinner and thinner financially, and they become less able to consume, well, I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Good are we if we don't consume?
Hopefully they're getting really angry and join unions and get radical.
Yeah. Right now we're outsourcing the middle class as fast as we can.
Right. And so who's left? And what's up with the people that are here? And, like, the future of young people in the job market is just frightening.
Well, that's because I think corporations have decided that there is more money to be made selling to the developing worlds that they've, you know, that they are currently embracing through the World Trade Organization and these fair trade agreements. After all, many of those people, they are seeing their income rise slightly. They have a little more disposable income. They can buy much, much more than a lot of our folks can now. We've kind of spent ourselves, so it's on to new markets. And I think that's the long-range plan. I think that, you know, the corporate America is quite content with having a large number of Americans doing things like be baristas and do laundry and, you know, the things they need so they look good when they go to their corporate offices.
And that they've been dependent. The ruling class in this country has been dependent upon the working and middle class to sort of turn a blind eye to what we've done with our foreign policy. But as we see this foreign policy begin to redound poorly on Americans, I think we get closer and closer to a tipping point, and I think it's up to us to accelerate that process with information and, in, from my point of view, to keep it absolutely nonviolent, because I think that all of these questions are going to be settled ultimately by what I call the three B's, ballots, bullets, or bodies. And when we keep it to the question of both ballots and bodies doing mass actions, then we don't get diverted, then we don't get confused, and I think that's part of that, that's part of our mission in the alternative media, is to keep on having the consciousness be quite high and always generate hope. Always talk about historic, the victory that happened, and locally over here, this is the victory that happened, because any good sociologist will say, if you tell the stories of success, then you generate hope, and that will increase activism.
And, you know, I think it's really important for, like, the work you're doing, Tom, and others are doing, to take back the, to reclaim aspects of of the idea of nonviolent change through nonviolence, because I think, you know, again, the corporate press, what has done, like if you watched anything about Martin Luther King last, or, you know, earlier this month, they've, you know, again, they've pulled the teeth.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be nonviolent, but that doesn't mean that you're not militant.
Yeah.
You know, passive, you know, they want you to be passively nonviolent as opposed to actively nonviolent, which means, you know, you go in and you trespass, you put your body out there on the line, you just know you're committing acts of violence, which is a different version of what we're getting. I mean, if you based it on TV's version of Martin Luther King, you've got the impression that he just went around hat in hand and asked white people to be good, you know. They forget the fact that he was organizing economic boycotts, mass demonstrations, and what have you.
Yeah, and he got killed organizing the sanitation workers.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, union action it
That's
was.
A fact.
Right. Well, we ask for people to call in, so I can give out that number again to see if there's anyone ready to dial in and give us some information from out there in listener land. 503-231-8187. Give us a call and let us know what you think.
I'd like to give out another number, too.
Okay.
This is an announcement and a phone number to go with it. We are going to be organizing civil resistance, speaking of nonviolence, civil resistance to this awful war. And if you want more information on that, if you want to get involved in our nonviolence trainings and preparation to go and offer this nonviolent resistance, please call White Feather House, which is part of the Portland Catholic Worker. The number is 503-327-8250.
Okay, we'll run that by again toward the end of the show.
Good.
Make sure everyone gets their pencils out. So why don't you tell me a little bit about the Catholic Worker? What's the history and how'd you get involved?
Yeah, started in 1933 by me. No, I'm just kidding.
You're a kid. You couldn't have been doing that.
Some days I feel a little older than that. But Dorothy Day, who cut her teeth in advocacy journalism as a young woman during the and who actually went to prison with the suffragettes in Washington during World War I, then she saw what was going on in the labor movement, and she said, well, they've got a good structural analysis, but they're not providing for the people on the street. As the Depression started and there were many, many homeless, she also, just in her own personal life, she had a conversion to Catholicism. And she started this as a kind of a synthesis between offering hospitality to people who were victims of this system and doing nonviolent resistance toward what she called this filthy, rotten system. That's verbatim. And she did that the rest of her life. Her last arrest actually was, I think, right around 1976 with Cesar Chavez in one of his campaigns. So she kept up a lifetime of both opening a house for homeless men in New York, and then that movement began to grow, and there were about 100, we're still, you know, small, but there are about 185 such communities around the world. And the Portland Catholic Worker has gone through several iterations, beginning back in the 70s with people like Jenny Nelson and Johnny Baranski and others. Then on through other houses, not having any direct connection to the one before. We're an anarchist movement, so there's no connection outside of just the philosophy that Dorothy had, which was gentle personalism. So the two houses that we have now, one northeast and one north Portland, the only connections we have with the past iterations are just personal connections, but we're renting one, we're buying one, and we're offering hospitality to women in transition out of homelessness. And then our other half of that mission is to offer nonviolent resistance, or at least to be hyperactivists.
Okay. So the people that are homeless then can find a place, a shelter.
If we have a bed, yeah.
And is there transition work that you do with them, or what happens after they check in?
Well, every Catholic Worker is different, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of them are more sophisticated than we are. We're not obviously a social service agency. We get no money from either government or church, just to be really clear. There's no connection with any parish or anything like this. In fact, we don't even have any. We were founded, the Dorothy Day House, we were founded by a Mennonite, a Buddhist, and a tree-hugging pantheist. we had one Catholic who actually was part of our core community for about 3 months, but and I think we've got another one who might be joining us at White Feather House. But Dorothy was never too fussy about that. She was a real Catholic herself, and she influenced Catholic changes in their dogma even. I mean, she had her, literally, she cited in footnotes in Pachamentaris, for example, and she went to Rome to fast and say that you've got to call for complete nuclear disarmament and a couple of other things, and she actually was noted. Her opinion was noted in these documents, which were influential and remained so. So, you know, with this, we're just kind of carrying this on, and every Catholic worker has, there is no mothership. There's no hierarchy, so we all define who we are just based on those two missions.
I see. Okay. And do you get media coverage in some of your work?
We have our own little newsletter. It's called Candles. I don't know if we get very much media coverage, although I will say the very first time we went out to Vigil, there was one media organization out there to cover us, and it was KBOO.
All right. Wouldn't you know it? Okay, Tim, you have something to add to this roundabout conversation we're having here?
Yes, I do. While we're in here, warm and comfortable, tonight, the nutrition service workers are having a rally, and they're at the Portland Public School. They're confronting the Portland Public Schools. They started at 6 p.m. tonight at the PPS Administration Building at 501 North Dixon, if anyone wants to come down there and join them. What's happened is after 10 months of bargaining, the nutrition service workers have yet to reach an agreement. The district insists on health care takebacks. That's an interesting phrase, including a proposal to eliminate health care for all newly hired part-timers. This means low-wage workers can't afford to pay for their own health care. And as a result, we all pay for it because they have to go to emergency rooms or whatever to take care of their own health. If you want to, come on down and support the SEIU and others at that rally. That is 501 North Dixon, right here in Portland.
And it probably won't be covered in the local newspaper.
It probably won't, yeah.
We've got one more announcement from the Portland Catholic Worker, and that is we vigil every Tuesday evening from 5:30 to 6:30, just for 1 hour, at the Military Recruiters at 1317 Northeast Broadway. It's been interesting. We've had one of our folks got arrested about 3 weeks ago, and she's got a trial date coming up. And we've got a fellow who comes out every week, and we suspect that he's paid actually by the recruiters, maybe they take up a collection, whatever, but he comes out and literally gets in our faces and yells at us. He's a veteran, but it was really interesting last week after we did our normal hour out there, and he's been coming for a couple months, and he didn't come out there until we showed up with huge signs like 2 foot wide by 3 foot high showing American service people with prosthesis coming back from Iraq. I mean, really rough stuff. Very hard to look at, but we need to tell the rest of the story because all of their literature, all of their posters are happy, fit young people. Come here, come in the armed forces, and this is what will be your future. And we say, well, you know, that's not the whole story. So literally, young people coming up to that office were gasping. I am not exaggerating. They were literally taken aback by seeing, for example, a very fit young man struggling to stand up with his new prosthesis. This is the real rest of the story. And the next week, this fellow showed up and he gets right in our faces and yells and says that we don't have a right to be there, et cetera, et cetera. So 2 weeks ago, we had an interesting sort of clash because one of the Vets for Peace is a a wonderful man who admits openly that he's suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome because he was a combat medic in Vietnam. And the two of them kind of squared off, and we didn't... It got pretty dicey. I told him, well, you know, if you guys actually start swinging at each other, then we nonviolent Catholic workers will have to step in between you. Then you're responsible for what you do to us. And they never actually took a swing at each other, but it was very ugly. And then last week, we went out to a little restaurant afterward, had a French fry, and came back down the street. And this fellow was there with a bucket of soapy water washing the windows. This fellow who had been harassing us. And it's like, what? You didn't yell at us enough, so you're making up for the rest of your cash handout this week? And, you know, we never saw any money exchange hands, but this guy is there every week, and it looks kind of fishy. I don't know. This is the same government who's planting stories, and one indie media responder to the story said, we're engaging in some pretty dirty tricks, planting stories in the Middle Eastern press, stories that come straight out of DOD. You know, Pentagon is writing the news and buying space. They're certainly not above sending somebody out to give us a little grief. But now with that, you know, you can come out and you could get arrested. You could get harassed. What better invitation to...
What fun.
Yes, nonviolent peace activists.
And that's on what night? I mean, you know.
Tuesday night.
It turns it into like a weekend activity,
yeah,
or something on a Tuesday.
5:30 to 6:30. We'll give you the, you know, what's legal, what's not, what's arrestable and what's not. So you get to choose what your level of involvement and risk is. But we would like to treat the military recruiters like crack houses. We want them out of our neighborhoods.
I'm sure there are people that agree with that.
Well, you know, it's not just the military recruiters, though, you need to be dealing with, because, unfortunately, our two leading senators are working quite hard to bring military dollars into Oregon. I went to a military procurement fair last week, and Gordon Smith gave the little lead-in speech about this is an important way to build a sound economy in Oregon. Bring in more military dollars. And it was amazing how many companies were there seeing this as an alternative, since the rest of the economy seems sort of flat. Here's a good way to secure some government contracts. Everything from, you know, making armor plate for tanks to gluten-free bread for the troops who might have food allergies.
Well, now we're back to my first announcement. If you want to prepare for nonviolent resistance, it is actually the senators who are our target. So that's exactly right. We have to go to the decision makers at every level. And each person who... here's what's happening with the recruiters is that I see young people going in there. And more than 50 recruiters have quit their jobs out of just unwillingness to do this anymore, because this war is based on a pack of lies, because it's clearly an imperialistic adventure to control oil. And people are coming back dead and wounded, and they're killing people over there, and they're never going to recover from that psychologically. So the recruiters all make these decisions, and they're tough decisions to make. And I acknowledge that. And then we have to jump to the people in the political world, mm-hmm. at the very top. You're exactly right. And we need to know much more about who is profiting locally from war profiteering, and that whole sector of people you saw lining up at the trough.
Funny you may ask, because in the February issue of the Portland Alliance, we're going to be printing a list of companies that are doing that. But, you know, Ron and Gordon, they're the only two senators in the Senate who jointly file request for defense appropriations for the state. They work together like they're all on the same team. Well, they are all on the same team, I guess, to bring dollars into the state. And that's, you know, part of what this fair was all about, was building that relationship so that we'd see the money coming in.
And I'm not sure closed bid contracts for transnational corporations in Iraq should be our first priority these days.
Well, you know, one of the things that was really, you kept hearing as you went to booth to booth to booth and talking to the people who organized this, was that, well, it's important because, you know, these defense dollars are important because, after all, they pay living wages. They're good jobs. They're like, you know, what union jobs used to pay, one guy told me, you know. So this is obviously a substitute for, you know, getting our fair share through collective bargaining is we simply sign on a deal with the war machine.
Well, I mean, it was what happened in Germany. And I've heard a lot of folks say, I lived through that era, and what I see in the United States is frightening. And when we can silence our consciences for lucre, we are on a very slippery slope, and that applies to each and every one of us, all the way from each voter to each recruiter, to each person who's thinking about what job. And the nonviolent resistance can inform the unions, too, that people care about this. When we worked at Honeywell in Minneapolis, we had meetings every month with the workers. So we were protesting what they were doing, and we met with the workers, and our list of what we expected, the number two item was, well, actually was part of number one. It came after the comma, with no loss of jobs. And this is absolutely vital to do that kind of outreach to people who are making the goods of war, to understand that the peace movement is their friend, that we're interested in campaigning for their rights and for everything that they deserve. And we also want them to think about this. And at Honeywell, lots of workers either asked for a transfer over to some other part of that corporation, or they quit out and out. And some of them did so quite publicly.
That's such an important thing to do, because it's a major wedge,
yes,
drive between organized labor and the other parts of the movement.
Yeah.
Right, and which is also covered in the media in a very dismal outlook. And Tom, I really appreciated your the hope business, where if we're involved in things that we have to remember that we're doing it for positive, and there really is a great deal of hope that we can, you know, make an impact.
And there are reasons to hope.
You unions, have a few you want to list?
I have a couple of reasons.
Okay,
here.
Go.
You know, unions are political.
I've heard as much, yes.
They're political at their base. They're about social change and civic commitment. And next week, right here on Labor Radio,
yes, that we're going to be back next week.
We're going to have Larry Galizio here, state representative who was elected by grassroots efforts. He's a labor-friendly kind of guy. And we're going to have Rob Wagner from the AFL-CIO Oregon. He'll be here in the studio with us. And they'll provide us with some evidence as to how we can change things, even though, as we discovered today, the U.S. media are rapidly being monopolized by a dwindling number of parent corporations, most of whom have a conservative economic agendas which don't reflect the interests of the American people.
Right.
And it's not all an uphill battle, but we have to keep fighting.
Right. And you guys can call in next week, you know, with your questions, or because I know you'll be listening and calling in. When we ask for caller in, nobody called in tonight. We'll give them one more chance, 503-231-8187.
Well, you know, if they don't call in tonight, what they need to do is the next time they see a TV broadcast that's anti-union or read something in the paper that's anti-union, is pick up the phone, ask for the news director or the editor, and let them know that what they're putting out there is false information. They start hearing from enough people that they view as consumers, it can have an impact.
Yeah, and these editorial boards, as Dave illustrated with his story earlier about Lammet Week, they're approachable. You can call up the Oregonian and say, I'm a member of this group. You've just stated something we don't regard as correct, and let's have a meeting.
Okay, we have to wrap it up here. This has been great fun, and I thank you both for coming in, and thank you, Mick Malcrone, out there in teacher land. So we'll wrap it up, and we'll turn it over to our engineer in the back. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lane.
Thanks, Lane. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by AFSCME Local 3336. representing the employees of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality by advocating for working conditions, pay and benefits, supporting political activity that promotes pro-environment and pro-labor positions, strengthening labor coalitions, and actively organizing members. More information at AFSCME3336.org.